This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn, and today we're live at the Conservancy of Southwest Florida in Naples. Later this hour, we'll hear about the otters and other wildlife at the Von Ark's Wildlife Rehabilitation Center, and I have to ask about that curious habit that otters have of juggling rocks. We'll talk about python trackers, panther protectors, and raptor rehabilitators, but first, we wanted to get a little background on the Conservancy from the president and CEO of the organization, Rob Moher. Mr. Moher, thanks so much for talking with us today.
It's great to be with you here, Julie.
We're also going to be talking with Dr. Heather Scazza Acosta. She's the Education Director here at the Conservancy. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And as always, for those listening at home or in your car, we'd like to invite you to be part of the conversation, too. Give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU, using the hashtag GCL. So first, Rob Moher, tell me a little bit about the Conservancy. Is this part of a national organization, or is it 100% local?
It is 100% local. It was founded here in Naples in 1964. And like many good nonprofits, it was founded because there was a problem that had to be solved. And the problem back in 1964 was they were going to build a road from Naples down to Marco Island right through what today is known as Rookery Bay National Reserve. And it was a group of Neapolitans that banded together to stop the road to nowhere, which is what they dubbed it. And they gathered signatures, 6,000 signatures. They rolled out the people opposed to the road in front of the county commission and said, here are the people opposed to the road. Show us the people for it. And the road was stopped. Rookery Bay was saved. And that's how the Conservancy was founded. So it's locally based and locally focused.
It's interesting you said that there were native Neapolitans. Yes. There aren't that many native Neapolitans. There are so many people that come here from somewhere else. It seems like people get here and they suddenly love the environment and want to protect it, and kind of draw up the drawbridge and start really work, get kind of become a local by advocating.
Absolutely. So these were people that had a long connection with the area, but they wanted to keep it beautiful. They understood, Julie, that protecting the environment in Southwest Florida was protecting their quality of life. And they knew that this road was going to destroy the thing that attracted them here, the beautiful beaches, the lack of 18 tall high rises, such as on A1A on the East Coast. And so they wanted to protect what it was that attracted them to this area. And I must say, they were celebrating Earth Day well before Earth Day was established nationally by taking action.
Exactly. So what's the relationship, just for people who drive by all the time, what's the relationship between the Conservancy and the Naples Zoo? I mean, you're close neighbors. Do people get things confused, think you're...
No, I think the Naples Zoo and the Conservancy have a fantastic partnership, and particularly in the last 5 to 6 years, it's really grown. And so we're benefiting from the Zoo Conservation Fund, which actually funds some of our python research work, which we're very grateful for. It's a very synergistic relationship. People sometimes do confuse us with the Nature Conservancy, which is a global conservation organization. And we have a fantastic working relationship with the Nature Conservancy as well. But what's unique about the Conservancy of Southwest Florida is we're based locally, regionally, actually, in the five counties of Southwest Florida, and that is our exclusive focus. So though we have representation in Washington and Tallahassee, because a lot of what we deal with down here has those federal and state elements to it, we are based here and focused exclusively here.
It's interesting that it's regional. You cover Collier, Lee, Charlotte, Hendry, and Glades counties.
Correct.
And there's explain to me a little bit about the symbiosis between the rural counties and the coastal counties and the challenges
Sure.
of representing both.
Well, that's a great question. So about 25 years ago, the decision was made to move from the Collier County Conservancy, which we were founded as, to become the Conservancy of Southwest Florida. Why? Pollution doesn't stop at the county line. Panthers just don't stop. We know we have panthers now north of the Caloosahatchee River for the first time in many, many years. So the wisdom, I think, at the time to become a regional organization is that we sort of represent the greater Western Everglades ecosystem. And when you look at it from a science ecological perspective, it all makes sense. All the water flows. Things that are happening in the Peace River watershed flow down southwest. We're very concerned about Lake Okeechobee because those impacts affect the coastal of Southwest Florida. So it really makes sense to look at it as an ecological whole, and the greater Western Everglades ecosystem is that which we are protecting.
So it all started with protesting a road, but now it's grown into a public policy team, a scientific research team, educational outreach, a full nature center, and a wildlife rehabilitation hospital. Do you think people even know all that's here?
Probably many people don't know all the elements of the Conservancy, but when I try and give people the 30-second version of why does all that matter, those are the tools in the toolkit. That's how we get our work done. But we're really here to do four things. We're here to protect land, water, and wildlife. And we think if we do those three things well, we secure our future. And so that's where the quality of life piece also comes into place. But that is it. We're here in all five counties. We're protecting land, water, and wildlife and securing our future. And that's a pretty simple but very broad mission. And you need all those tools in the toolkit to accomplish the mission.
Well, and I find it interesting that it's also kind of a destination of its own, in its
Absolutely.
Own right.
You know? A lot of the early founders of the Conservancy understood that once they saved Rookery Bay, you know, and that was done through legal, through grassroots advocacy, it wasn't enough. We had to educate people. We had to understand the science of why Rookery Bay was so ecologically important. How did it function? Then after we understood that, we had to translate that so the public would care, because no conservation area is an island. So what happens outside of the boundaries of Rookery Bay and Henderson Creek affects what happens inside Rookery Bay. So education became very important, hence the establishment of the Nature Center in 1982, and we've grown significantly in education since then.
Well, and on that educational outreach team, we have Dr. Heather Scazza-Acosta. She's the education director here at the Conservancy. So I'm going to pivot over and ask you to tell me a little bit about what you do.
So my role at the Conservancy is I have sort of a partnership position. So I'm here as the director of education, and we do all sorts of field trips, outreach. We do K through 12 education, mostly in the non-formal setting, but supporting our formal school systems in those five counties. And we also do adult education, adult programs. And of course, everyone that comes to visit the Nature Center has a wonderful, interactive, engaging experience. I always say we have the lucky task of being able to get people excited about science and excited about the environment in ways that they maybe don't otherwise have the opportunity to do. The other part of my role is that I am a full-time faculty member at FGCU as well. So the partnership between FGCU and the Conservancy is a very important one, and part of my job is to make sure that we can offer opportunities for faculty and students at FGCU to come down and do research, participate in programs, and support those education and science efforts at the Conservancy.
So what did you teach at FGCU?
I teach all sorts of environmental education courses. I teach environmental biology of Southwest Florida, so I've done a little bit of everything, hope to do a wider variety in the future.
Is it incredibly different teaching people who are in, you know, K through 12 versus adults? I mean, how do you have to change your message at all?
Sometimes you do and sometimes you don't. So obviously we want to be age appropriate. And so the things that, you know, we want to get kids involved in, we always say we want hands-on, inquiry-driven, student-centered education. But I would argue that it's not much different for adults, right? So when we invite people to the Conservancy and the Nature Center, it's just as fun for them to encounter some of our ambassador animals, to be able to get their hands on things and learn that way. And when you can get them excited and interested, that opens the door to all sorts of educational initiatives. We get to then talk about conservation and some of our policy initiatives and the scientific research that's going on.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining the show, we are at the Conservancy of Southwest Florida with the show live. We're talking about all the things that they do throughout the region. And as always, you're invited to join the conversation. You can give us a call whenever you feel like it at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Now, Dr. Scazza-Acosta, Director of Education, this is a big weekend for you. What's coming up?
This is our biggest celebration of the year. So we have our Earth Day celebration coming up this Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m.
What can people expect when they get here?
Well, a little bit of everything. I love that this event is really inclusive. We want everyone to find something that really gets them excited. Of course, we focus a lot on the kids. We have games, crafts, prizes, animal encounters. Mr. Science will be joining us at noon with a really fun and funny educational presentation. The zoo is coming at 1 o'clock. But of course, there are things for adults as well, all sorts of vendors and presentations they can engage in as well.
And there are going to be food trucks too. I saw that.
There are going to be food trucks.
You don't have to tell me twice about that.
That's right.
Well, I was here last year and it was really busy. There were a lot of people and it was, I don't want to say chaos, it was really well organized. I mean, you can figure out what you're doing and where you're going and see what you want to see and kind of pick and choose.
Well, we have a wonderful staff team. We also engage our volunteers. We have a great team of interns that really helps things run very smoothly. And because they're all passionate about what they get to do here at the Conservancy, they're also really excited to share that with all of our visitors on that day.
It's almost kind of like a reinvention of the way to expose people to the nature around them. Because a lot of times, you know, you go and you study, you're like, oh, well, there's a tiger. Well, we'd never see one of those here. But these are the animals that are here.
We want to focus on our local Southwest Florida environment. And there's so much to celebrate here. We have such a unique environment and such unique ecosystems. And we work so hard to work on, you know, the conservation efforts and the science behind that. But Earth Day is really a celebration of all of that. So for folks that are already interested in conservation efforts and are already interested in the environment, obviously they're going to be attracted and have a wonderful time. But this is a day where also it's just fun. So we hope to really get people engaged and interested that might not otherwise be as well.
So there will be live animal programs. There's going to be an alligator feeding encounter.
That's right. So we're going to have our animal care naturalist will do a demonstration on how we're able to train the alligators using clickers so that we can take care of some of their basic care. And so that should be a pretty neat presentation that most people don't, you know, on a daily basis get to see.
Yeah, and I don't want to put down roadside attractions, but I do feel like it's a little bit more responsible to see the people that are biologists that know what they're doing dealing with this.
Of course, right. This is, we absolutely take pride in the care of our animal ambassadors. They're such an integral part of what we do. You know, nothing gets a kid or an adult quite as excited about wildlife as being able to encounter one up close that they wouldn't normally get to see. So they're a really important part of what we do, and we work our hardest to make sure that their care is exceptional.
And then there are also electric boat tours happening.
Absolutely. So you can go out for about a half an hour on one of our electric boat rides. And that is a common attraction on an everyday basis, but something that absolutely our Earth Day goers will get to do.
There's live music, face painting, exhibitions, and of course we already mentioned the food trucks. It's like my second bullet
point
for me.
You can come back to that. It's fine.
Well, right now we're in a big hall where I believe a number of the presentations are going to be taking place. But the whole campus is going to be crawling with activities, and you also have some permanent exhibits here, which I don't know that people even realize they can come and check out.
Yeah, so our Nature Center will be open all day. We'll have plenty of staff and volunteers manning the visitor center and the Nature Center so that folks can go in and kind of interact with the things there. But also our Von Ark's Wildlife Nursery, our Wildlife Hospital Nursery window will be open for viewing all day. So you can kind of understand a little bit more about what goes on in our wildlife hospital and the very important work that they do.
Animal Hospital Nursery. I mean,
it doesn't get much better than that.
More cute than that,
right?
I mean, really. And tell me a little bit more about the Nature Center. There's a huge aquarium in there where people can. How impactful do you think it is with kids and even adults to be able to see all the local fish in that huge? And then, of course, I think Luna's in there, right?
Luna's in there right now. Yeah, and she's getting big.
Tell me about Luna. She's a sea turtle, right?
Luna is our sea turtle. We've had her for about a year and a half now, and we got her through a program that was studying the effects on temperature on the sex of the turtles that hatch when they hatch. And so we got Luna. We've fostered her for about a year and a half now, and she's almost ready for release. So Earth Day would be a great time to come and see Luna for what could be one of the last times you get to see her before we're ready to release her back into the wild.
Before she heads out into the big blue.
That's right.
I wanted to ask you, what do you think is one of the things that is the most misunderstood thing about the environment in Florida? What do you think people aren't really getting?
That's interesting. So I think one of the most important things for people to recognize is our relationship with the environment here. So many people, and I'm a relative newcomer to Florida. I've only been here for about almost 2 years now. But I think that so many people move to Florida for the natural environment because we love what it has to offer. The beaches, the swamplands, natural ecosystems, you name it, people love it. And what we really need to pay attention to is how we can live in that environment and also serve it the best we can. It's not going to stay this place that we love to enjoy, where we like to recreate, where we like to live, unless we also understand the ways in which we can take care of it and the role that kind of everyone has to play in that. So many people don't think of themselves as environmentalists or conservationists, and that's okay. But there's something for everyone in being able to live here and being able to really value the place where we live.
It's kind of like there's almost something for everyone here, just even at the conservancy. I mean, you can be into veterinary health, you can be into biology and understanding and studying the way that sea turtles move through the oceans. You can be interested in just the estuary ecosystems, and you can still learn something from what's going on here.
And that's something we really like to demonstrate between the, you know, the Nature Center that's here, but also just in the work that we do, that there is such a variety of things that we are able to do to all serve kind of the same purpose. Earth Day is a really sort of broadening of that, because we want to make sure that everyone is sort of welcome, everyone finds something that they can get excited about, and then they can continue to come back and learn more.
And I'm going to switch back to CEO and President Rob Moher. We were talking earlier about how the Conservancy came to be and how it's continued to evolve. I think it's really interesting what she was telling me about people being part of the environment. Mm-hmm. Do you ever feel sometimes things end up being politicized and people feel like they have to define themselves as either environmentalist or not an environmentalist?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I think that's changing. And I think the reason why it's changing, if you just look at the last 3 years, this idea that the environment is over on the right side and the economy and our personal health is over on the left side is an absolute false dichotomy. And you saw that during the discharges of the blue-green toxic algae. You know, when you hear the stories of a lifeguard going to rescue a child in the water because the water is toxic and the lifeguard becomes sick with liver toxicosis from 3 minutes exposure to that toxic water, you realize human health is involved here. When you see businesses shutting down or tourism dropping because we have excessive red tide or these huge outbreaks of water in the Coosahatchee and the St. Lucie that is toxic, these discharges, remember the guacamole thick colored water on the cover of USA Today? Who wants to come to Florida if you can't swim in the water safely? So this idea that economy is separated from human health for the environment is what we preach every day here, because these are all connected, and they are connected especially in Southwest Florida, where our livelihood depends on the health of our environment. And so I think we're all in this together. I think that we need to stop thinking just about the environmentalists versus the economy people that want to have a good economic future. It's all one and the same. If we take care of our environment, we are securing our environment and our economic future.
That's an interesting point. And then I wanted to talk a little bit more about how are you funded? Is it all donations from local people here?
95% of everything we run our $8 million annual operating budget on is earned income through philanthropy primarily. So we get some program revenue, not much, but I'd say 85% all comes from private contributions, from grants, foundations, from events that we run. And so we are basically driven from the community and for the community. There's no large federal or state grant that comes in every year and that we apply to for $1 million. It is basically hard-earned. We have to show those donors and members, you know, what are we doing with their investment? And that's what it is. It's an investment. And so we pride ourselves on communicating that we're making a difference. We're a 4-star Charity Navigator rated nonprofit. That's the highest one you can get. So we pride ourselves on making sure when someone gives us that dollar, that we take that dollar and we leverage it with our volunteer time. We leverage it with in-kind donations, and we make sure we're spending it for the maximum impact to help with the mission.
That's an incredible sum from local donors.
It is. It's
how
actually
does that kind of backing from the community make you feel as the people that run this every day? I'll ask both of you guys that one.
Well, I mean, for me as a CEO, it's a huge vote of confidence for the team and what we're doing here. So I don't take credit for that. I'm inspired every day. You know, Naples is an incredibly generous community, but it's just not Naples. We're talking Charlotte County, Lee County, Glades and Henry County. And when I see kids that take their birthday money and decide to donate it to the conservancy so that we can save another animal's life, I mean, it pushes you harder and further. I think that's how I feel, Heather. And I know that, you know, we get inspired here every day by board members, by donors, and by the future board members, these young kids that are already taking action at 8, 9, 10 years old.
And I think it's exciting and inspiring to know that when our local community supports the conservancy, what they're really saying is that they are supporting education initiatives, environmental education initiatives. They care about the science that's going on. They care about the conservation efforts. And so to know that that message is getting across, that, you know, we live here and this place that we value so much is important, and to see them support it in that way is so inspiring.
Well, we're going to learn a lot more about that after we take a quick break. I want to thank you both, Dr. Scazza Costa. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for coming over and talking with us also, Rob Bauer.
Of course. Thank you.
I really appreciate it. We're going to take this quick break, but when we return, pythons and the tracking project that paid off big this week. We'll talk with the biologist behind that and much more when we return. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. For those just tuning in, Gulf Coast Live is on the road today in advance of Earth Day this Sunday. We are live at the Conservancy of Southwest Florida, which will be hosting its annual festival in celebration of the Earth Day holiday this weekend. Joining us now is the Conservancy's python biologist, Ian Bartosik. Hi, Ian. Good to see you again.
How you doing?
I feel like I see you every couple months.
We see each other often.
You're always doing amazing things.
Thank you
We're
much.
Also joined by Kathy Worley. She's the Conservancy's Director of Environmental Science, which covers everything from mangroves to sea turtle research and, of course, the pythons. Kathy, thanks for talking with us.
Happy to be here.
We are at the Conservancy of Southwest Florida, as I just mentioned, talking about all that they do throughout the region. As always, you're invited to join the conversation at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. Ian, big news this week, all over the papers. You're a python star. What happened? What did you find?
So we were sharing a neat finding from this year's breeding season tracking Burmese pythons, and I guess it caught some buzz that we tracked a male python to a breeding aggregation that had 8 pythons total, 7 males, including that male Argo, and a large 115-pound female python.
So what did you think when you saw all that?
It was a lot of python in one place. You know, we're close to 300 pounds of python in one spot, so I kind of had to see it to believe it.
Yeah. I didn't want to see that.
No, it's not for everyone.
So this kind of tracking of Burmese pythons is really kind of unique. Why do you think more people aren't doing something like this throughout the Everglades?
Well, that's a great question. Here in Southwest Florida, our habitat, the mixed hardwood swamp forests, is different than the eastern Everglades, those marshlands, those levees they use to hunt pythons. It'd be difficult to try that approach here. So through our research project, it evolved into a bit of a removal campaign with our partners. And so on the doorstep of Naples, we've been pretty successful using pythons to find pythons. But that's just one tool in the toolbox, and we do need a more long-term strategy for sure. This isn't going to solve the problem. We've just been pushing back in some key areas of Southwest Florida.
It's a much greater payoff when you've tracked one and you get to one of these aggregation, you said?
Mm-hmm. That's a nice way of a nice term, breeding aggregation. I like to think so. It takes a lot of time and tech to get there, and it's a costly research project, but at the end of that rainbow is usually a big pile of pythons in the breeding season like this one we just were reporting on.
They have breeding season? Is this mm-hmm. the time?
The breeding season's over. Oh. So in short order, those females that we didn't catch and around the rest of the state are going to be depositing their eggs that were fertilized, and then they'll sit on those for 2 months. And then around the 4th of July, all those little baby pythons will hatch out and leashed into the ecosystem.
So the one that you just got, that's probably like the closing time python?
That was the peak of the season. That was around Valentine's Day.
But that was back then.
What was really cool, though, about that observation is one male python of many that we track. We have about 20 pythons we're following. His name was Argo, and he was our VIP this season, our very important python. So a few days before Valentine's Day, we found him in a culvert pipe underground, and he had company. He had a 100-pound female that we caught. And then we let him go. And surprisingly, 3 days later, we tracked him a half mile away, and he was with these 7 other snakes together, having a big snake party.
So we talked once before about resisting the urge to go out and just hunt these invasive animals. Can you make the case for me once? I mean, you know, I'm not saying resist it, but we talked about going out and doing those python hunts. And you told me before about how that's probably not going to ever get us ahead of that population.
It's something all pythons remove humanely. Any python that's removed humanely is a good thing. So you got to combine all these techniques. So what, like I mentioned, what may be working on the eastern Everglades, hunting snakes on levees, maybe, we'd like to know if that's achieving a level of control over there. But over here, we can't really take that approach, although ours is a hybrid. We do hunt for pythons. We catch them with our hands. Some of those are good candidates to work into our tracking program. We refer to them as sentinels, and then we redeploy them, and they're working for us. So,
but just hunting alone before, but doing the math, with how many eggs do they lay?
Average clutch size is 42. We've seen everything from 12 to 95 eggs inside of a Burmese python.
Yeah, that's
yep.
a lot.
So it's an uphill battle. Eradication does seem unlikely, so we're looking for some level of control on this population. And so that's why the research is so paramount to this removal effort, because we need to understand this creature better and better so we can make really logical, informed decisions on how to get after them.
Well, it's a foreign creature to us. I mean, it's not
It is. We probably should have started with that. It's a non-native snake, invasive from Southeast Asia. These Burmese pythons have been in the Everglades since the late 70s, early 80s. And they
got there just as released pets?
It's likely many introductions, released pets, escape pets. Hurricane Andrew put more pythons into the equation, but it isn't the start of the Burmese python. So this is a lesson for one that's out of the bag. And so we need to be vigilant on the other invasive animals that could be out there. That's why people need to be calling in sightings, and there's an app you can use on your phone, the I've Got One app, and we'll have an army of observers out there. So this is an important issue to follow because of the impact they're having on our native wildlife, and that's why we're involved in this research project, because they're decimating native wildlife.
Yeah, that impact is something that people may not realize. I mean, it's just, hey, they're out there in the Everglades. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to see one because, you know, I don't go out there. Why would I care?
So when we bring these animals in and we perform an animal autopsy and necropsy and we see what's in their stomachs, you have to see it to believe it as well. There we find everything from small deer and bobcat claws, raccoons, possums, wading birds, you name it. It's a laundry list. And other people have done the same in the research world, and we're talking about 37 species of bird already reported from the bellies of python, 20-something species of mammal. So this is a generalist. They eat across the food chain, and that's very worrisome.
Yeah. They have no natural predator out there?
Well,
except for humans?
Well, alligators, American alligators are great predators for pythons, and we've actually documented eastern indigo snakes are endangered snake eating pythons, so that's a plus. But they're striking a balance now, or will, with the across the Everglades ecosystem, and I think that's going to reverberate for the years. We'll see. They're changing up the game out there.
Mm-hmm. So it's rare to actually see one of these camouflage artists out there in the wild, but what should someone do if they do come across one?
Right. They're so cryptic. You're highly unlikely to ever see a Burmese python. Most of our research is in the rural edge of Collier County, but in the simplest terms, if it's 4 feet, has giraffe or greater, has giraffe-shaped patterns on the back, and is as fat around as your arm, and it doesn't have a rattle on the tail, it's probably a Burmese python. You're very unlikely to see these small pythons as hatchlings, and we often get a lot of people confusing our native snakes, our corn snakes, our banded water snakes, because they have a pattern.
They think it's once.
A python, and don't kill on first sight. You know, these native snakes have a tremendous service to the ecosystem. The Burmese python happens to be an invasive snake, is a beautiful creature. We have a lot of respect for these animals, but they are creating quite the havoc out there at the moment.
I did that, though. I confused a little native snake mm-hmm. and thought it might be a baby little one of those. And
right.
I sent the picture to someone. They said, no, you're wrong. Leave it alone. And I did. So.
I think that picture came back to me one day.
That could have been for me. That
right.
could have been. So Naples Zoo has a couple of pythons in captivity mm-hmm. over there. Do they act any differently in what we see when we go see them in captivity versus in the wild?
Well, first off, Naples Zoo is an excellent partner with our research. They support a portion of our research through their conservation fund, and the rest is private philanthropy. But their exhibit over there is pretty awesome. You can see one of the longest snakes on the planet, the reticulated python, Ka, who's an impressive beast for sure. And then there's a smaller Burmese python in there as well. So your question, are they behaving like they will in the wild? Well, when we had a little bit of a cold snap this past winter, if you want to call it a winter, I went over there and I saw that the Burmese python was sort of laying in the water bowl with its snout up out of the water. And that was a neat observation to see, because maybe many of her other cousins out there were doing the same in the wild. So, yeah, I guess on some level it's a great exhibit. Yes, so they are behaving similar maybe in the wild.
So what's next for you?
What's next for
continue
us?
Continue to watch and track your pythons?
Continue to track pythons and live to tell about it, I guess. It's quite the assignment, and we're focused on expanding the research and removal and raising awareness and spreading the word about this animal and keep the pressure on the python for sure.
All right. It's so great to talk with you every time.
Thank you much.
Ian Bartosik. And also, we are going to now pivot and talk with Dr. Kathy Worley. She's the Director of Environmental Science here.
Yes, I am.
We were talking about pythons. They get a lot of attention. But there are a lot of species of wildlife that the Conservancy tracks and advocates for, from panthers to sea turtles to protecting mangroves. Tell me a little bit about what you do here.
Okay, well, I'm basically a mangrove biologist, so I have to give a shout out to them, because They took it on the teeth this year from Irma.
Mangroves?
Yeah, they did. If you've been down to the 10,000 islands recently, you'll notice they're just decimated.
Yeah.
And if those forests hadn't been there, you know, think what would have happened to the urban area, because they really took it on the chin for us.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, it's wait and see to see how they recover. I don't know if I'm probably dating myself here, but if you remember something called a chia pet.
Yeah, oh, I know the chia pet.
The vegetation that comes out. Well, they're starting, the mangroves are starting to do that, the ones that weren't killed all right. And that's one
so
of the.
So we have chia 10,000 islands happening right now?
Yes, we do. And that's one of the mechanisms that they have to recover. And that's with the blacks and the white mangroves. The reds do a little bit different. But anyway, we're hopeful that they'll recover.
On the mangroves, refresh my memories. Are there some that are right next to the coast in the water? Which ones, where's the white one and the black one and the red one? Is the red one more inland?
The red ones are the ones with that they call walking trees. They have those prop roots that kind of extend out into the waterways, and they're generally found along the fringe. Mm-hmm. However, our forests around here are more of a mixed bag. It's not unusual to see a black mangrove next to a white mangrove next to a red mangrove.
Mm-hmm.
But if they have their druthers, shall we say, they would have the reds closest to the waterways, followed by the blacks and the whites that are more upland.
Mm-hmm.
But for most of ours, are pretty much mixed.
Why else are mangroves important? They're important for the fact that, I mean, they can help, you know, take the brunt of storms that are coming to us. But what other purposes do they serve?
Well, they are really important if you like fish. If you eat a lot of fish, you got to love mangroves, because what they do is they are nature's nurseries grounds. Mm-hmm. About 75% of all commercial fish that are or fisheries,
mm-hmm.
actually the juvenile stage of that fish spends some time in the mangroves. So if you like to eat fish, you got to love mangroves.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do like to eat fish, so I do enjoy the mangroves, and I think they maybe provide a little bit of a habitat and help with erosion, things like that.
Yes, they also do that. They do a lot of different things. They protect against storm surge also, not just winds.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do is the root systems and the trunk systems, if you have a lot of water coming in, it kind of breaks it up. So it hits them first before it hits us. It's a similar with
slowing
the
down a wall of water.
Yeah, similar with the wind. And but they have a lot of really... they're real important for birds, for nesting. I mean, a lot of wildlife utilize mangroves, and recreation is big too.
And every time I think of a mangrove, I think of a little raccoon running around in its branches. So what are some of the successes that you've had in your research, or some of the things that are pretty memorable that you've seen, things that may have stuck out and surprised you?
Well, this isn't exactly mangroves, but it was a kind of a funny story. I was actually doing a bathymetry, which is where you're measuring the surface of the water, mm-hmm. the bottom of the water, and looking for the topography underneath. And we were doing it old school, where you use like a measuring pipe and you're walking along with a pipe and yelling out measurements versus a GPS. This is before, this was quite a while back before they had equipment that would actually measure mm-hmm. this. And I was going along, just doing my thing. I was about waist deep in water, and all of a sudden, I just fell right over. I got hit in the back of the legs, and I was like, oh, no. You know, and I'd seen sharks earlier in there, and I thought, well, maybe it's a shark. And I turned around, it's this manatee. And it just, you know, you're not supposed to touch them. You're not, you know, I was being a good biologist and not touching them, trying to ignore it, but it kept hitting me. And then it rolled over its belly, and it had become accustomed to humans and would come up to them if they were in the water because it wanted its belly scratched. And so this is just another thing.
Were you able to not scratch the belly?
I did refrain, but I did push it a little bit to get it to go away from me.
Oh.
But I was trying to be good.
You are a very good scientist. I would have had a very hard time doing saying no to a belly scratch from a manatee asking. So you also are involved with sea turtle work?
Yes, our science department we have research on two different types of sea turtles mainly. Mm-hmm. And right now with Earth Day, it's also really close to the start of the nesting season for sea turtles. And on this coast, it's primarily loggerheads, and that's led by one of our premier biologists, David Addison, who actually has been doing this. This will be his 35th year of this program.
Yeah, we had him on the show a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
He was out there on an island, Key Waden Island?
Yes,
Key Waden. And he was getting the beach all prepped up for that. So it's pretty interesting. And then you also have Luna here, who's getting ready to be released.
Yes, she is. She has gotten big enough, and she's ready to go out and be on her own and be a sea turtle.
And I understand there's going to be a tracker on her?
Yes, and Dr. Jeff Smith, who works with Kemp's Ridleys, is going to put one on her, even though she's a loggerhead. But she's a juvenile stage, and Jeff is really familiar with the juvenile sea turtles. And he works with the Kemp's Ridleys looking for their migration patterns, because he put satellite tags on them. And mm-hmm. the Kemp's Ridley is the most endangered sea turtle. So we do a lot of different sea turtle work. We're looking at trying to figure out where they go, where their feeding grounds are, so that we can better protect them.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea to know what they're up to when they're out there, because you don't see them much. Are people going to be able to track with when she has that tracker, when Luna has her tracker on her? Are we going to be able to, or is the public going to be able to maybe see, like, keep track of her online?
Fingers crossed, yes. Technology sometimes always doesn't work in the way we want it to.
Oh, don't we know it, yeah.
But fingers crossed, yes, and stay tuned, and we'll put out a announcement on where you can go to follow Luna.
All right. Well, we look forward to hearing more about that. Thank you so much, Kathy Worley, Director of Environmental Science. I really appreciate you talking with me today.
Thank you very much.
So protecting the environment is about more than research and education. It's also about politics, whether we like it or not. So we're going to switch gears now, and we're joined by Nicole Johnson. She's the Director of Environmental Policy here at the Conservancy. Nicole, I know you've been on my show a number of times, especially during session.
Yes.
Are you feeling a little bit more relaxed now that session is over, or are you already thinking about next year?
We are already gearing up for next year. Certainly, as season winds down in Southwest Florida, policy has no season. So mm-hmm. we're still going full speed ahead. And we're really looking forward to gaining early momentum on a fracking ban statewide and getting legislation geared up for that. So we are starting our campaign already, and we're very hopeful that it will go further next session.
So this past session, it did okay in the Senate, didn't do well in the House. We've talked about it on the show before. Do you think there's going to be anything that's going to change between now and then to get it to move a little bit?
Well, there will be different leadership, and we're very hopeful that the incoming Speaker of the House will allow the bill to be heard, and that's going to be one of our major asks for the new Speaker. It will be Representative Oliva, and we're very hopeful that whether he supports the ban or not, he will allow the bill to be heard. So we're very hopeful.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask a little bit about any new issues you may be coming up with. Is there anything else that you're going to be going to session next year talking about, or are you going to keep your focus on the fracking mainly?
Well, the fracking ban is going to be the Conservancy's top priority, okay, as it has been the past two sessions. But also, while we were very fortunate to get $100 million for Florida Forever this past session, we need to get that constant source of funding for the program. So the Conservancy, and you'll see probably all of the environmental community, really pushing for that continued constant secured source for Florida Forever. That being said, we're very happy that the $100 million is there, because we have a number of projects in Southwest Florida that are certainly ready, willing, and eligible to be acquired through Florida Forever.
Remind us a little bit of what Florida Forever is.
Florida Forever is the state of Florida's land acquisition conservation program. There are a number of different subsets to the program. You have Florida Communities Trust, which really deals with matching funds for more urbanized park areas. You also have the Rural and Family Lands Program, which is a conservation easement program on ag lands. And then Florida Forever is the program that focuses on specific project areas, usually large-scale project areas. The CREW, Corkscrew Regional Ecosystem Watershed, is one of mm-hmm. the Florida Forever projects. And there are still parcels that remain to be acquired in the CREW area. So we're very hopeful that that's a good direction for the Florida Forever funding.
Do you have anything on deck about oil exploration out in Big Cypress?
There is exploration that is going on as we speak. Burnett did receive their renewed State of Florida DEP permit to go out and do the exploration with the large fiber-sized trucks. we and our partners did get better permit conditions on Burnett's permit. We still, of course, oppose the activities, but those permit conditions will better ensure that if damage is done, there will be restoration within specific time frames and to specific standards. So
you kind of got a rider on there.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And we'll make sure that we're out there monitoring and keeping an eye on things. So that is also going to be an issue for probably the next several years, and we're very involved.
Okay. But now, hyper-locally, can you tell me a little bit about the Collier County RLSA? That stands for Rural Land Stewardship Area. What is that?
The RLSA is 195,000 acres in far eastern Collier County. It surrounds the Immokalee area, though Immokalee is not part of it. And we really see that as kind of the last frontier, the last battleground, where agriculture, environment, and development are all vying for dominance.
So people are looking to develop that.
Yes, you have large landowners. They're called the Eastern Collier property owners, and they're looking to put in a number of new cities within this area. Ave Maria was the first city to go in. They certainly aren't built out. At build out, it will be 5,000 acres. We have Rural Lands West that is currently going through their permitting process. That's going to be another 4,000 acres. We also have a couple additional towns that we know are on tap. But all told, this could end up being 45,000 acres of new cities, new villages,
of pavement,
and cars that have to go from town to town into the coastal area.
It may end up being one of those kind of like a feeder city, like a bedroom community for people that are driving in to work in Naples where they can't afford to live.
Or to Miami.
It could
be a bedroom community for Miami. So a tremendous amount of intensification in an area that most people consider to be very rural and very low density. And 45,000 acres of intensification in the wrong location, including in areas that are considered critical for the endangered Florida panther, is going to have absolutely devastating effects. So the Conservancy is looking at the intensification of eastern Collier County at the local level, and Collier County right now is reviewing that RLSA overlay, and they're going to be having workshops over the coming months, probably through the beginning of next year, to take a look at the different policies. We have the county's workshop schedule up on our website, so we encourage people to go there and take a look and get involved and participate. It's about protecting panthers, it's about protecting wetlands, it's about protecting water resources, and it's also about protecting the taxpayers, because when you look at that much development spread out through an enormously large potential envelope of land, you're going to have to build roads and other infrastructure to connect that. And from one of the graphics that the landowner's consultant provided several years ago, we totaled up all of the cost of the roads. And in 2015 numbers, it was $7.8 billion, with a B, billion. Mm-hmm. And that is going to be a cost that will be borne in large part by existing coastal urban taxpayers.
So you said there are going to be workshops and things like
yes.
that going on in the next several months. Is this something they're going to be looking at over the course of several months?
Yes.
The county's looking at this?
The county's looking at it. They started their workshops in January. Mm-hmm. They had initially anticipated finishing up in the summer, but they saw that there really was just so much to take a look at that they've now expanded those workshops into early 2019. And at that point, once the workshops are completed, and the workshops, everyone's invited, everyone can participate.
Now I'm thinking like concerned people that either if they're concerned about their property taxes to pay for it, or if they're concerned about the environmental side and development.
Yes.
If they're concerned about that and they want to get involved, they can go to these workshops. How do they find
Absolutely.
Out about them?
Absolutely. Well, if you go to our Conservancy website on our policy page, we have information about the RLSA, and it connects you to the workshop agenda. And if we don't have it up, we will put a link to the Collier County page that has all of the background material on this. And I also want to mention that this is sort of a parallel process to a federal permit that these same landowners are asking for. And this would be called a habitat conservation plan permit. It's an incidental take permit. Habitat Conservation Plan makes it sound like it's environmentally wonderful, mm-hmm. but it's really an incidental take permit to impact habitat for panthers and other listed species and to allow for this 45,000 acres of development. So that's another area where the Conservancy is very concerned. You can learn more on our website. And if you're concerned and interested in more information on Rural Lands West, which is the second town that is being proposed in the RLSA, there's still lots of opportunities to comment there. So go to our website. Get involved, participate. This is planning the build out of Eastern Collier County. And once it's gone, it's gone.
Yeah. If you wanted to speak up, this would be the time because the trucks may not be rolling yet, but it's
absolutely.
In the discussion.
Absolutely. And entitlements are being gained.
Yeah. I want to thank you so much. Nicole Johnson, the Director of Environmental Policy here at the Conservancy. Thanks for talking with
me. Thank you.
If you're just joining the show, we are at the Conservancy of Southwest Florida with our show live today. We're talking about all the wonderful things that they do throughout the region. And now I get to pivot to the Von Arcs Wildlife Hospital. I'm talking with Joanna Fitzgerald. She is the director of the Conservancy's Wildlife Hospital. I was there today. I had to drop off a little baby turtle.
Oh, no.
He was the cutest little thing. And it was hard to say goodbye.
It is.
But there's, I think we have a picture of it on our social media. We're at, on Twitter, we're at WGCU and WGCU Public Media on Facebook. But tell me a little bit about what happens when somebody brings in, for example, right now, baby animals that they find. My fear when I walked in was, is he going to become food for one of your raptors you're rehabilitating?
Never, ever, ever. Part of the reasoning for that is it's unethical, first and foremost. That would be unethical. But also, we just don't know what the animal has experienced before they're brought in. If it's gotten into poison or pesticides or things like that, we would never feed that to our animals. So that's secondary. But first and foremost, each animal that's admitted is a living creature that we are going to do everything we can to try and help. So either it can be released back into the wild or there's no more suffering. So it's just not even a possibility in our minds.
I really had that fear. So it's really great to have that that relieved from me. So what kind of animals are you seeing coming into the hospital right now?
Well, it is baby season, so almost everything you can think of is breeding, from bald eagles, screech owls, red-shouldered hawks, mockingbirds, blue jays. All the turtles are moving around laying their eggs as well. Possums, rabbits, raccoons. It's breeding season in Southwest Florida, and it's busy.
And we got a chance to see a little baby possum being fed in there, too. The temptation is to want to take care of these little guys.
Right.
But tell me why people should not try to do that at home.
It's never what's in the best interest for the animal, and we have to remember that. I get that these creatures are very adorable. They're sweet. You are never doing what's best for the animal if you're trying to take care of it for yourself. They have very specific nutritional requirements. Also, by habituating them to people or even possibly household pets that are around, if you have that animal in your home, you are not raising them to be wild, and they will not be able to survive in the wild. So especially with babies, if they don't get the proper nutrition young, they can have developmental issues for the rest of their lives that we can't reverse. Always bring them in to us as soon as possible or call us so we can try and see if a volunteer can help transport. If you're busy and you're working and you can't get it to us, people will find baby birds right now. They'll leave them at their house. They'll go to work for 8 hours. Baby birds get fed by their parents every 15 minutes. You leave them alone.
It's hard being a new mom, huh?
Mm-hmm. You leave them alone for 8 hours. That baby has missed, you know, 4 times 8, 24 feedings that it would have gotten with its parents. Already it's at a deficit just in that amount of time. So we're there every single day, even on Sundays, holidays. People need to call us so we can get the animals the help they need.
I was sitting there looking at that little guy, and I was that little turtle. I'm not really a reptile person.
No.
I don't really know what I'm doing here, so...
And the worst part is people try and take care of them, and then they'll call after a couple months when suddenly the turtle isn't moving anymore or it's got funny spots on its shell, and they'll say, well, I think it was a red-bellied turtle. How can you even possibly take care of it if you didn't even know what it was in the first place? So
exactly.
Yeah.
Well, that worked out for
that
little guy who was found on his back. What's kind of an average day for you? I wonder if you ever get overwhelmed with so many animals there. How many people are working there?
Well, an average day depends on the season. Right now, average days are incredibly busy, and literally every single minute of our day matters and counts. So we're highly efficient. It starts with any of the animals that are already in the hospital needing to be fed, medicated, clean cages, all of that. So again, if you think of those baby birds that are getting done with us, it's every 45 minutes because we can do that with the type of diet that we're providing. So coming in, checking the babies, making sure everybody's looking okay, that no one's looking worse from when they were last night, and then starting on the feedings. If we have animals that are getting fed six times a day, they're our first priority, so we can space those out every 2 to 3 hours and have them done by 9-10 o'clock at night.
So you have overnight people too?
Well, we have
them
here
every 15 minutes for
yeah,
baby birds.
Well, the baby birds are only fed dawn till dusk. Remember, mockingbirds aren't going to be active at night. The owls are active at night, but the yeah. songbirds aren't. So we try and mimic what we do as best we can to what the natural experience would be for the animal. So we are not 24 hours, but we are usually done by 10, 10:30, and can put things to bed for the night. So anything that needs medication, many of these, just like with humans or your pets, they're every 12 hours, you know, mm-hmm. so we need to get them done first thing so we can get them done 12 hours, you know, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night.
So before we run out of time, and we're almost there, I wanted to ask about these little otters. Have you mm-hmm. seen the videos of otters juggling rocks?
I have seen the otters juggling rocks.
It's hilarious.
It's super adorable, yes.
And you have a couple of otters right now in the hospital.
Well, we had them.
We did
transfer them to another center that's a little better equipped, a little more rural for those babies right now, and that's key for them. But otters are incredibly clever. They're very social. I can't say exactly what they're doing with those rocks. I know evolution isn't frivolous, so there could be some evolutionary adaptation to being able to handle
rocks. If anything in evolution is going to be frivolous, it'd probably be an otter, though.
It could be. You're very right.
You said that they're so fun.
They are. They're incredibly inquisitive. So not only do we have to take care of their medical needs, we have to take care of an animal's psychological needs. So behavioral enrichment is very important with creatures like that.
Oh, so your job is to play with them.
Not to play with them, but to give them things that keep their minds stimulated.
And watch them play?
We do take a little peek every now and then.
If I got paid for that, you know how much time I would
yeah,
be
you
logging
got
online watching
300
them.
Other animals that need you to get back
that's
to work.
That's true. All right, well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. It's always great to talk with you.
Thank
Joanna
you.
Fitzgerald with the Conservancy's Animal Hospital, Von Ark's Animal Hospital. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Our show today was produced by Rachel Iacovone, and yours truly. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Special thanks to Kevin Trueblood, our engineer. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1 WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM NPR for Southwest Florida.